Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Don't miss the Crick, Rick, and Jonathan Show every Saturday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Studio B, right here at Revolution Radio.
The journey begins to fun, health, and freedom.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious, makes you so sick at heart. But you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Rick, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
All right, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Free Association. It's just after 4 o'clock in the afternoon in sunny Newcastle, and relatively sunny Newcastle anyway. It's a little bit chilly, but the weather's not been too bad. The last few days, temperature went up a little bit. So we're running about 15 degrees at the moment, which is manageable. Once it gets below 10, I start to get concerned, but 15 I can manage. And that means it's 11 a.m. on the East Coast. And I've got an hour to fill, and I've got some things to talk about. So let's just quickly talk about the reports of a tsunami after an earthquake in Tonga. I don't think that's happening because it's been cancelled. So I know the tsunami warning happened, but I think that's a fairly standard thing after a 7.3 earthquake anyway in the Pacific. So I don't think we need to worry too much about a tsunami. It occurs to me, though, that back in 2004, I think it was, when the the earthquake and tsunami happened in Indonesia, Thailand, wherever it was, Thailand, wasn't it? I knew that was going to happen about a month beforehand. I was doing a lot of psychic work at the time. And I remember wandering around in Newcastle and just getting this sense that a quarter of a million people were going to die in some kind of... I thought it was going to be just an earthquake, but it turned out to be the tsunami. That was about 3 weeks before the tsunami happened on Boxing Day, the day after Christmas. And I was getting these vibes about the beginning of December, so about 3 weeks earlier. But it was difficult to make out what it was going to be. I just knew a quarter of a million people were going to die. I wasn't sure exactly what it was. The obvious thing is an earthquake. So I assumed it was going to be an earthquake. I was quite relieved, actually, when it happened, because it was playing on my mind and there's nothing I could do about it. But the thing that is strange to me is if I can pick that up 3 weeks in advance, then surely there must be other people who can pick that up 3 weeks in advance. There must be a team of people. What about the remote viewing people? Do they not pick these things up? So I don't really understand. I mean, I wasn't in control of what I was doing. It was just something that was like a feeling about impending doom or whatever. So there was nothing to really differentiate it. But there must be a way to do that in a way that's kind of coordinated and organized and structured. I'm not necessarily sure I would want to have the same feeling again. If I was going to do it, it would have to be in a way that was structured and logical and rational rather than the intuitive kind of kinesthetic way that it came over me. But I would think there's a team of people somewhere that are doing remote viewing that would be able to pick these things up. I'm not sure if there is or there isn't. We're obviously not talking about it if there is. But I would imagine the CIA has got something going on, and probably the KGB have got something going on. So that was the first thing I wanted to say. Let's tick that off the list. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the activist groups that I've been going to recently as well, because I haven't really talked that much about Rebels on Roundabouts recently. So I do this thing on a Friday afternoon, which is ridiculous, which is standing on the Tyne Bridge with a big yellow sign. Yesterday it was Justice for the Vaccine Injured on the sign, but everybody else had, there was about 15 of us. They all had different signs with different bits of information or different slogans on them, different headlines, because it's basically marketing what we're doing. We're marketing a different point of view just by being on the bridge at Friday evening rush hour is the idea. So went down there at 3:30 in the afternoon and I stayed till 5 o'clock. There were still people on the bridge when I left. The idea was to be there for a couple of hours, but 5 o'clock seemed reasonable to me to finish because it was getting dark. And to me, it's like people are just concentrating on driving if it's dark. During the day, when it's sunny, you can make more of an impact. But we've got music. Somebody takes a Bluetooth speaker down there. So we've got Bob Marley and we've got... various protest songs along the way. We got Muse and we got Bob Marley. Those are the key ones for me. But it's a good idea. I don't know how much rebelling on roundabouts there is going on in the States, but there's quite a few different groups in the UK doing that sort of thing. And it's effective. So the physical activism, giving out leaflets, giving out... there's a thing called the Light Paper in the UK, which comes out once a month. So some people give those out. I give out leaflets or whatever. Have a conversation with people. I had a conversation with a police officer yesterday who was asking us what we were doing and how long we were going to be there, and suggested that I was careful with the traffic, and I was miles away from the edge of the road, but everybody else was stood at the edge of the road. So the police are neutral on these occasions, and they have to know what's going on. So I'm fine talking to the police. She asked me what I was there protesting about, and I did tell her people dying from the vaccine. And she wandered off and talked to somebody else. So it's all good. We've got quite a good relationship with the police. They helped us out once when somebody was in a scuffle with a guy who was slightly the worse for wear a few Fridays ago, and got slightly injured. But the police helped us out and took the guy away and helped him to calm down, I would imagine. Had a conversation with him and put him in a cell somewhere, or wait for him to, the effects of the drugs he was on and the alcohol he was on to wear off. But overall, I think the idea of standing on a bridge with a sign wouldn't have occurred to me 3 years ago, but it's a very good idea, because the idea of an alternative way of looking at the world isn't getting through the media, so we have to just get it through another way. And this is direct marketing, really. You've only got a very small amount of space on a board that you're carrying, so the headline has to be good. It has to get people's attention, and the call to action has to be good if there is one. But the key thing is just have a good headline to get people's attention as they're driving past. We had a very positive response yesterday. Very positive indeed. And the other thing I did this week is on Thursday evening, I went to a meeting, which is at an event space on an industrial estate, which is about 5 or 6 miles north of Newcastle. I'm not going to say exactly where it is, but it's a social club of sorts. So that's the big event for the activists in the local area. There's about 100 people showed up, and there's space for the kids as well, so the kids can do a bit of playing while they're there. Yeah, human billboards are a good idea. I think human billboards are a very good idea. I mean, I do take the mickey out of it and say that I'm standing with a sandwich board that says the end of the world is nigh, but They do get through the noise. There's a lot of, not literal noise, but there's a lot of kind of interference, and there's a lot of static around the place. You've got to be very direct with a small amount of space. It's got to be a very direct, very clear headline. Humor's always good. Sarcasm's good, because the British like their sarcasm. And there's a couple of boards that are very sarcastic that I like, and they get a good response. But the one I had yesterday was getting a very good response as well. So those are the things I wanted to say, really. It's just to encourage people to try the boards approach. Have a look at rebelsonroundabouts.com and see what they're doing. I don't know if it's in the States, but it's definitely all over the UK. There's no reason why it shouldn't be in the States as well. So I'm just trying to encourage people to do that sort of thing. It's got to be some kind of not on the internet activity. That's really what I'm about at the moment. I'm obviously sharing links as well, but the main part of what I do is talking to people at meetings and exchanging information at meetings, and we kind of organize the events between us. There's no actual leader as such. People volunteer on a kind of weekly or fortnightly basis to organize the next couple or to encourage new people. We were expecting 5 new people as well on Friday, of which 3 showed up. So that's not too bad. And it means that There's if there's new people cycling through, it takes the pressure off the people who are there every week. That means they can have a week off here and there. If we've still got 15 people on the bridge, then that's a core group. That's a core number, really. You need to have kind of a reasonable number of people to make an impression. And I think 10's enough, but 15's better. All right, I've got a couple of clips to play today as well. I've got a clip of Andrew Mercurius. Alexander, sorry. Alexander Mercurius. I knew that wasn't right. Speaking to George Galloway on a show that George Galloway did about the Nord Stream 2, what we can call a terrorist attack, basically. So this is Alexander Mercurius's take on that particular incident.
Mercurius is a distinguished journalist and analyst and the editor-in-chief of the excellent magazine, The Duran. What do you think? Can we park the issue? Was it the Americans? And if so, what does it say about Europe that allows itself to be attacked by its chief ally but continue to follow their orders?
Well, I think there's a lot of things we can say about this which do point firstly to the United States. And let's first say that this isn't the first time that there's been an attack on a Russian pipeline. Many people don't know this or have chosen to forget this, but in 1982, and this is documented fact, there's been books about this in America. People who were involved have discussed it. They've openly boasted about this. Way back in 1982, the Soviet Union, as it then was building pipelines to Europe, gas pipelines. The United States fiercely objected. The Reagan administration, with the signature of the president himself, operation. Software was introduced into one of those big Russian pipelines, Soviet pipelines. This is in 1982, and there was an explosion. This software led to an explosion. It was in Western Siberia. The explosion was of an enormous size. It could be seen from space. So this is not the first time that there's been an attack of this nature on a Soviet or Russian pipeline. And in that case, it is incontrovertible. It is not disputed that the United States was involved. In this case, the latest attacks on the Nord Stream pipelines, there is an important difference because these pipelines, obviously, they are largely Russian-owned. Gazprom owns 51% of the Nord Stream pipelines. But, of course, the Germans own significant shares. They are part of the European infrastructure, the energy infrastructure. This happened in the sea waters of European states, Sweden, Denmark, Germany. The Russians, the biggest owners of this pipeline, they're excluded from investigation. They're not even allowed to go see what had happened. All of the various countries involved, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, they're conducting investigations, which it turns out are independent of each other. These were waters controlled by the United States. The United States has a history of doing this sort of thing. The United States is known to have fiercely objected to these pipelines built from Russia to Europe, extending back to the 1980s. It's a circumstantial case that it was the United States, but frankly, it is a compelling one. I personally would be very surprised if the United States had not been involved in some way.
All right, so that's Alexander Mercurius speaking with George Galloway on a show that he did last week. And Boy Solomon is asking me what the protest was about. So the protest on Friday is called Rebels on Roundabouts, and it's an anti-lockdown protest, essentially. It's an anti-lockdown kind of vaccine caution protest. I always pick the vaccine boards, but other people are doing boards with things about the Great Reset and digital currency on them. So it's a mixture of things. And everybody's got their own kind of thing that they want to protest. So we all just join in together. There was 15 of us yesterday. So it's a growing protest. And they've been going for a year and a half, I think, altogether. I've been doing this for about 6 months, so I'm late to the party, really. But the other people that are involved have been through a winter already, so they know how tough the winter's going to be. So yeah, it's a regular weekly thing that we do in two or three different places. But there's no specific... initially it was anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine, basically. And now it's anti-New World Order or anti-digital currency or... And we're more or less anti-everything. Anti-transhumanism, we could say, as well. All of those types of things we're anti. So it's really just a question of... I basically do that protest for my own benefit, my own mental health. I don't attach to converting anybody or waking anybody up. People are perfectly capable of waking themselves up at the time that's right for them. So I just do it to keep myself sane, basically. All right, yeah. So that's pretty much it for that. We've got quite a few people in the chat room today. It's a good turnout. So I'm going to name check a few of the people that have been active in the chat room over the last hour or so. So the people I've seen are Dryfly Guy, Net Effect, Malia, Pat Rabbit's been in as well, Maced 139, Captain Fred, Doc Lenny Times in under the pseudonym of Lemmy Hout. We've got Fleeced and Boy Solomon all in the chat room as well. So we've got a good turnout today. And it's a good chat room to be sharing information in, or it's a support. It's not really a support group, but there is support there. If you need it, there'll be somebody there who can offer a little bit of support here and there, but not everybody by any means. All right, I've got another piece, which is an interview that Adam Curtis did about a year ago with Russell Brand. And most of the Russell Brand has been edited out on this particular piece. So it's good because it doesn't have him interrupting and doing his Russell Brand impression. So I'll play a little bit of this. I might play 10, 15 minutes of it and see where we go from there.
The term comes from a rather interesting guy who wrote about what it was like to live in the Soviet Union in the middle of the 1980s, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, because there wasn't really any protest at the time. What he pointed out is that everyone knew that everything was not right. They knew that those in control had no control. They knew that those running the economy were not in control, that everything was corrupt and often completely fake because the leaders were pretending they were in control. Everybody knew this, and the leaders knew that everybody knew this, but nobody did anything about it because there was nothing else. It was normal. And he coined the phrase hypernormalization to describe this. Somehow, you knew that everything was a bit odd and a bit unreal and often fake, but because there was no other picture of the world and you were so within this system, you accepted it as normal and just went on. And what I'm trying to argue in this film is not that anyway, we're like the Soviet Union. We're a very different society. But what we do share with that time is a sense among a lot of people that things are a bit odd and unreal and sometimes fake, and that those in charge know that they're not in charge, and they know that we know they're not in charge of things, that everything is a bit chaotic, uncertain. We distrust everyone in charge. We also know those in charge allow a great deal of corruption to carry on without doing much about it. We know that they're not in control of the economy. They know that we know they're not in control of the economy. But at the very same time, we are so much a part of that system that we don't have any vision of an alternative. And I include by that the left. They don't have a vision of an alternative. So we accept it as normal. When you see another newspaper article coming out saying, we're actually supplying arms to the Yemen to allow the Saudis to bomb Yemen. We go, yeah? That's a very good example. The reaction is the most interesting thing of our time. We sort of expected that the arms industry and the government in this country would allegedly allow arms to be supplied to this war that we know is causing horrific civilian deaths, and we have no way of controlling it. We know that, and we just accept it. It's normal. But actually, it's wrong, isn't it? We know that however much we feel it might be wrong, nothing's going to change. It is impotence in the face of a chaotic world that we think those in charge have no control over, but we accept it. So it's not just impotence. We're passive and we accept it. So in a way, we are as complicit in it as our leaders. But we do that because no one gives us any alternative. We accept it as just normal. When you have an alternative, you can see suddenly something. It puts it in perspective. You've got an alternative. You see things truly for what they are, and you can pull back, detach, and go, I don't like that. This is better. Or you don't. At the moment, there isn't. And I think one of the great faults lies with the left, who say they do want change. I mean, the real change at the moment is coming from a strange, weird mixture of right-wing nationalism and racism, as far as I can see. But whereas the left are failing to offer any alternative. It feels more and more like rhetoric. I mean, I point out in the film how strange it is that in the recent years, all the attempts to change the world radically, which had a great deal of force behind them, the Occupy movement, the Arab Spring and Tahrir Square in particular in Egypt, Syriza in Europe, all have stalled. They had great power behind them. They had great goodwill behind them, and they stalled. So, and I argue in the film it's because they confused process with content. They assembled, they were very powerful, they had a great slogan behind them in the Occupy movement, great deal of emotional goodwill from people who would not normally support revolutionary movements, and they just stopped. I argue in the film, where I try and demonstrate journalistically in the film, that no, we're not living in the old idea of capitalism that we used to think about. What we've shifted into is a new system of power, which I see as being fundamentally managerial. There are vast new bureaucracies around us, including things on the internet, but also in finance and in management systems in all the places that many people work in. And their aim is to essentially keep the world stable. I mean, that's what finance is desperate to do. It's always wanting to monitor the world, looking for risk. Risk is a fascinating word. I did a word search on LexisNexis, which is the cuttings file of all newspapers. Up until about 1988, 1990, the word risk hardly features in journalism. I mean, it's obviously there. And then suddenly in the 90s, it rises up. And it's this, what drives modern managerial capitalism, if you can give it a word, is this desire to avoid instability, to always analyze the past, look for patterns that are happening now that look like dangers in the past, and then adjust. That there's always a sort of a right thing to be. And I see it in our own personalities as well. There's always a right way to be psychologically. There's always a right body mass index to have. There is always the right stable thing to be. That's fear of change. It's very deep, not just within the conservative mindset, but also within the liberal mindset in our society, is fear of change. Look what happens when you try and change things. They point to Iraq, for example. Look what happens when you try and change a country. They point to nature and they say, look what happens when you try and change an ecosystem. You can never tell the consequences of it. And then they point back and they go, well, look what you try and do with the Russian Revolution. Look what happened there. But what they ignore is the fact that you live in a society that comes out of a revolution, which has got fantastic and wonderful freedoms in it. We had a revolution in this country. It can be good, but it can be dangerous. At the moment, we live in a static world where we're absolutely terrified of all change. Whereas someone like me would argue is that change can be dangerous, but can also be thrilling. I think it's in these giant bureaucracies which have grown up, which are intimately related to our politics, like finance. The interesting thing about the 1980s is everyone thinks that Thatcher and Reagan really were successful, but actually increasingly historians are looking back and going, no, they weren't. They came in saying they were going to regenerate industry, but by about 1986-87, most of the industries in Britain and America had collapsed because of the economic experiment. So what Thatcher and Reagan did was they said they turned to finance, and they said, can you help us? And what finance said is, well, we'll lend the money. Wages were actually collapsing at that point. So what happened is you had a switch and they gave power to finance, and finance came in and introduced the idea of lending on a much grander scale. The politicians allowed that because they facilitated all sorts of new acts of parliament that allowed all that lending to happen. So what you got is a shift away from the idea that you were on a constant travelator of increased wages, increased security in the industries you worked in. Your income stagnated and it was supplemented by lending money. Finance, for example, got a great deal of power. Now, underlying finance is a deep desire to keep the world stable, to avoid chaotic situations. So we began to move into that world where we're always trying to avoid risk. That idea begins to spread out, not just literally in terms of you lending money, but the idea of avoiding risk becomes a central thing in our society. And I would argue that we've all become terrified of change, which is conservative. But you see, I think that why it doesn't have any attraction change, it's our fault as much as them. You can't just blame the politicians. It's us as well. One of the great enormous changes of our time is the rise of individualism. It started really in the 1970s in modern terms, and it's this idea that you and I believe that what we want and what we think and what we feel is the only authentic thing, and we shouldn't be told what to do. It's really strong. It's really powerful. Mrs. Thatcher was on the coattails of it. Punk movement was on the coattails of it. It dominates our society. And the problem for politics of the rise of individualism is that it can't deal with it. Politics requires you to say to people as a political party, come with me, join with us together, and we will use that collective power to change the world. But to do that, you have to accept that you're part of something. You have to surrender yourself to something. And for the radical movements, that was a disaster. But more than that, it was a disaster for politics generally, because political parties fell away. So what then politicians, they were then faced by is the fact that they didn't have mass support. So they couldn't do the main thing that mass democratic politics rose up to do, which is to be your representative, your bridgehead into power, because we had become like scurrying little piglets going all over the world and not joining together to form a collective action. No, it's not a side effect of marketing. Marketing comes in to make it work. Individualism comes basically out of the hippie movement, the counterculture movement of the 1960s. Where you were encouraged to be authentic by responding to yourself. That was the idea. And it was a reaction against what was seen as conformity. And it was a reaction against old style of politics where you were told what to do. It was just, I want to do what I want to be. And it was about finding the authentic self. The civil rights movement, which is an incredibly important movement in the 1950s and the 1960s, white activists and black activists joined together, and they spent years giving their lives, and many cases literally, up to trying to change the world, which they did. They surrendered themselves to that. Out of that civil rights movement came what was called the New Left. And the New Left said, well, if we can do this for civil rights, we can do this for everything. And then the movement stalled somewhere in the mid-1960s, because what began to happen was a new, what's called counterculture, rose up. And the counterculture was different from the New Left, because what the counterculture said was, you're never going to tackle the man, the power. You haven't got the power to do it. The way to do it is to change yourself. It was the sign of a new individualism. It didn't want to go down to the South and spend years in anonymity and danger trying to change the world. So what then happened is the argument shifted away from the idea of saying we can work together to change the world to saying, no, if we can actually be the vanguard of changing ourselves as people, then you change society like that. You change the people first, and then society will transform. And that sort of worked for a bit, but then bit by bit, the politics moved away, and you were left with this idea, you just transform yourself. And you have all these radical psychotherapy movements of the 1970s come up, which is you need to find your authentic feelings. That became the goal. And the idea that you're actually changing society as a byproduct began to disappear. And what then happened was that this strange thing began to emerge. If you are going to be a self-expressive individual, which was the ultimate goal, where you're authentically expressing yourself, how do you do it? Because actually not many people knew or had the confidence to do that. I argued in a series of films I made that really what happened was that modern consumer capitalism said, well, we can help you do that. We can actually supply you with lots of different things to allow you to express yourself, from ranges of cars to ranges of clothes to all sorts of products that you can use to express your individual identity, which was fantastic for consumer capitalism, because they could make lots more different things. So capitalism is not an inherently evil thing. It's it's amoral. It will always spot an opportunity and it will go for it. And what it spotted in the late 1970s, that were these people rising up who wanted to be themselves, and they realized that that allowed you to make lots of a much wider range of products than you had previously done before, and people went for it, and that allowed capitalism to make lots more money. You know, you saw all those adverts in the 1980s and 1990s, express yourself, because I'm worth it, was the great phrase. Then what happened, I think a great shift happened, which we haven't fully recognized, which is sort of what I'm trying to get at in the film, is the genius of modern power, is that it managed to do what politics failed to do. Politics can't deal with individualism, because how can you have a political party where everyone wants to be an individual and not be part of something? What modern managerial systems manage to do is square the circle. Look at modern social media. It manages to allow you to feel that you are totally yourself, expressing yourself online, typing angrily or beautifully or whatever you want to do out into the internet what you feel all the time. Yet at the same time, what you are is a component in a series of very complex circuits that is looking at you doing that and saying, hang on, if he's doing that, then he's very much like these people over here, which we've categorized like that. So we can say back to that person in the circuit, if you're doing that, would you like this as well? And you go, oh, you're all right, because it's a bit like what you've just done. Yeah. And it makes you sort of feel secure within your individuality. So what they've managed to do, increasingly in the modern systems of management, is accept your individualism and your expressiveness, allow you to feel that you're being more and more expressive, whilst at the same time managing you quietly and happily, so you become part of a very large group that you don't see because you're just the little component in the circuit. But the computers look at you and go, oh, well, there's about 300 million of those sort of types. We'll put them in that group. It's not a conspiracy. It's not a group of people going, oh, well.
All right, so that's Adam Curtis. Adam Curtis made a documentary for the BBC a few years ago, 2016, I think it was. That was a very, very good documentary called Hypernormalization. And he's coming at it from a different point of view, but there's room for different points of view on this show, at least. I can't speak for the rest of the shows on Rev Radio, but I'm quite happy to go in all sorts of directions. I don't limit the direction that I go in just because I don't agree with it. I'll take a look at everything. On this show, that's the point of free association, is you can go in whichever direction the situation leads you into. There's no fixed way of looking at the world. And for me, at least, I do move. My opinions shift all the time about stuff. And sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong. But at least I'm prepared to take a look. Is some more Adam Curtis. Here we go.
Do this. It's a system that can see from the information that it's reading from you and lots of other people the patterns that you are part of, and saying, well, we'll fit them all together into that pattern. Right. And it's benign in their terms. If you talk to the tech utopians from Silicon Valley, they will go, this is incredibly efficient. And they're right. It's an incredibly efficient way of managing the problem that politicians can't manage, which is our individuality and our desire to be self-expressive. Yes. Its problem is that it's fundamentally conservative, because it's feeding back to you more of what it knows you like. Yes, you could argue that modern Protestantism, especially, was again another way of trying to deal with the growing desire for individuality, which has been going on since the Renaissance or before the Enlightenment. This idea that you want to be yourself. Protestantism said, no, you don't have to be what Catholicism says. It's just part of something you're told to do. You can have a personal relationship to God. And there is a very important posh academic book written back in the early part of the 20th century by a man called Max Weber that argues that Protestantism and the idea that you have a personal relationship to God was one of the great motivations, the forces that allowed capitalism to come up. Because if you can actually achieve a relationship through your own actions with God and achieve salvation, then you can actually say, well, I can achieve all sorts of things myself in the here and now before I die, which may save me for when I die. So it actually made you more of a heroic figure, Protestantism, so that when you die, you will be a good person and you will go to heaven. And that gave capitalism this idea that it was a fundamentally good thing to try and achieve. You see this in the 19th century novels, where they depict great capitalists. They see themselves as heroic figures who are not only helping the world, but they're saving themselves. Someone once said, the sign of a great ideology is something that doesn't look like an ideology, that you just accept as natural and normal. So, for example, if you talk to technological enthusiasts or utopians from Silicon Valley, and you talk about Facebook shutting people off into their own little echo chambers, they'll say, but it's efficient. And what they mean by that is it works. It's actually dealing with the problem I was talking about of individualism, and it's allowing people to be assembled in groups yet feel individuals. And they're absolutely right. It is incredibly efficient. But maybe the whole idea of efficiency used in those terms is actually a political ideology, because what they're saying is we constantly keep people in this situation by reading stuff and feeding stuff to them. And that's conservative. That's a conservative idea, because then people, they get frightened of change. And if you get frightened of change, then you're actually feeding the power. And what I keep on trying to point out is that real power, it doesn't work by saying you must do this. It works well when we are complicit within it because we accept it as natural. And we are guilty in that. Do you remember the march against the war in Iraq in London in 2003? Probably the biggest protest march since the Suez thing in 1956, or even bigger. And everyone thought that's going to change everything. And they had a slogan which was "Not in my name." I thought it was an interesting slogan of its time. 3 million people marched and they were totally sincere about it. "Not in my name." And they then went home. You go back and the war is not in my name. Whereas real change, real political change would have happened if those 3 million people had again and again and again marched and again and worked and given themselves to that. They might well have had a chance of stopping the horror that has now happened in Iraq. Protest becomes feeling. It's not that there is the real kind of freedom is a religious one. It's a different kind of freedom. There are all different kinds of freedom. Mm. And the idea of freedom that we believe in now and we believe is inevitable and natural to our state is not. It's a construction. The version of us at the moment of freedom is a construction because there are many others. And one of the most powerful is the very opposite, which is a religious one, which says, "In whose service is perfect freedom?" The religious idea is that the self, which we worship at the moment, is actually a terrible prison. It's a cage that you are trapped. And again, you're an example of this. Maybe it's good to escape from that daily grind of having to listen to your consciousness constantly saying, "I want this, I want this, I want this." People live inside their heads very much because they're encouraged to. They're encouraged to think that is the end point. That's what we're heading towards. But actually, what's going on in those heads are things that people don't really want to tell.
Doubt.
Fear, loneliness, doubt. If you are going to be the right kind of individual, you mustn't have that. The politician who is going to get real power and take us somewhere in the future is going to have to deal with the things that are inside our heads, which is loneliness and fear, in whose service is perfect freedom. I mean, the other interesting area that in this is the modern ideas of love are about satisfying yourself, whereas the old idea of love was that you surrender yourself to someone else. And it's thrilling, but frightening, because you give yourself up. And that kind of love has disappeared. It will come back, I'm sure. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. You just can't. Mm. Individualism is here to stay. It's part of the future. And what a politician of the future who is going to change the world will do is somehow allow people to still feel they're individuals, yet at the same time will say, if you come together, we can actually transform the world into something extraordinary. And it will be thrilling, but it will also be frightening, and take them into that world. No one's managed to do it. At the moment, what's happened is a lot of the managerial systems have managed to make people feel they're individuals, but manage them. And we've got to transcend that. I mean, I think it may somehow come out of the internet in some way or another. Yes. At the moment, the technologists, the engineering people who dominate it, apply an engineering model to it. And engineering models are about feedback. And they say they constantly read you in the past and feed more back to you. It doesn't have to be like that. What it needs is a content, a vision of the future. And it hasn't got one at the moment. I have a very cynical theory about Donald Trump. As politics became more and more deracinated, thinned out, less and less substantial, and less able to change things or confidently able to change things, and power shifted away to all sorts of other things that we were participating in. Really what people like Trump are is they've become, they're not really politicians, they're pantomime villains. They've turned politics into a vaudeville. They come on stage and we go, "This is outrageous," in big capitals. "This is absolutely terrible." We tap away on social media saying, "This is really, really, really bad." A marketeer for online told me once, angry people click more. And clicks are gold dust. Really what those clicks do is feed modern power, and everything stays the same. If you click a lot, that's what those who run social media benefit from. You're actually keeping the whole thing churning over. If you have something like Facebook, which in its news feeds increasingly gives you what it knows you like and what you hear is what you like, then that's incredibly powerful, because you are shaping what they know and you're shaping above all what you don't know. Mm. Those who run social media will say this is efficient. They're not ideologists. They're not saying we must tell them this. And in fact, it's the algorithms that are doing that. Of course, they've designed the algorithms, but the algorithm's function is to give you more of what it knows you like, because that's efficient. That means that you only know what others like you know. And then there's another group over there who know what they know, the others in their group know, and they never meet. I mean, there's a fascinating quote on the day after Brexit from a social media activist who was a Remainer, but he wanted to find out what the other lot felt like, who were the triumphant that day. And he went onto Facebook and he tried to find through the custom feeds people like that. He couldn't do it. And he was actually shocked. I won't read you the whole quote, but it's absolutely fascinating. It's a man realizing that there are two halves of the world now so separated from each other that one half can't actually actively go and find out what the other half is feeling. Now,
all right, that's enough of Adam Curtis, I think. And that's the reason that we need to get offline and we need to talk to real people in a real meeting room. and have real conversations. Because if you don't agree with somebody and you're face to face, you can have a cup of coffee and you can agree to disagree. You don't have to have a big debate about it. You can just agree to disagree and still be good two good people having a cup of coffee. There's no exclusivity to, do you know what I mean? It's like the other side of the argument has got an argument. They're not demons. If you want to call them demons, then you're the one that's the problem. You're the one that's polarizing. But then you can project it out onto somebody else and say that the power structure is polarizing. But if you're the one that's calling people demons, you're the one that's polarizing, not the power structure. So, but you're less likely to call people, somebody who's sitting over a table with you having a cup of coffee, you're less likely to call them a demon. It's more human. It's more, as Lenny would say, it's more human scale. It's more likely to be a real conversation. Yeah, you're absolutely right, Lenny. They are afraid of the people. And that's why we'll win. Because they're frightened. They're frightened old men trying to hold on to power. And Kissinger's in his 90s. George Soros is in his 90s. They're not going to be around for another 5 years. They'll be dead. So there'll still be seven billion other people on the planet that aren't Henry Kissinger and aren't George Soros. And now, ultimately, we've got the power to do whatever it is we want to do, as long as we're prepared to have a conversation with people. Because it's going to take more than one side. It'll take more than the right to change the world, and it'll take more than the left to change the world. If we don't have a conversation with the other side, then nothing changes. So that's my perspective anyway. I like talking to people whose opinions are different to me. I know loads of people whose opinions are different to me, and I don't agree with everything they say, but I'm not going to call them a demon just for having a different opinion. And I will have a conversation with them, and I will go on a demonstration with them, and I will organize with them. And I will change the world with them, because I think that's the only way that we're really going to change the world, is to work with people who have different opinions to ourselves. If I don't want to sit in an echo chamber. I've got no kind of attraction to that at all. I want to have conversations with people. I want to have real conversations with people. And that means I'm not going to agree with everybody. And they're not going to agree with me. But that's why it's a conversation. 100 people all agreeing with each other isn't a conversation. It's an echo chamber. Anyway, that's me on my soapbox. So that's what Adam Curtis does for me. He sets me off. There are plenty of places you can find me online. One of which is the podcast, which I've been neglecting a little bit. Which is on Podbean. So I'm still doing the Technocratic Tyranny Blues music show. I think I may cut it down to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, because I tend to be at meetings on a Thursday, and then Friday there's nobody really listening, so there's not that much point in doing a show on a Friday when there's nobody listening, when I could be somewhere else at a meeting listening to a speaker. So I might cut it to Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I haven't made my mind up yet. But there is that. There's the potential for adding some radionics to it. I've got a radionics gadget that does Royal Rife frequencies that I'm potentially going to add underneath the music on the Technocratic Tyranny Blues show. I haven't figured out how to do that yet, though. So the gadget's plugged in. And the software's on the laptop, but I haven't figured out how to do it yet. So I'm still working that out. All of this is trial and error for me. But you can also find me on BitChute at the moment. I'm quite active on BitChute. So if you look for radio projects on there, or look for Free Association radio show, roundtable, and podcast, and you'll find me. And there's a few people signing up for that one, so I'm happy with that one. I'm also on Odyssey and on Rumble and on Locals. FreeAssociationRadioShow.locals.com is the community on Locals. That's probably going to be a little bit more active than everywhere else once I get it moving. Takes a bit of time to get these things going, though. That's the trouble. And I'm spread out in too many places, probably. I need to kind of trim where I'm actually spending my time and focus on the things that are working, which at the moment is the radio shows and BitChute, surprisingly. I've tried BitChute before and it didn't work, but now it's working for me for some reason. I don't know exactly why. It's just the timing, probably. Or maybe I've changed enough that I can connect with people on BitChute a little bit better now. I don't know. It's interesting, though. It's an interesting combination of people. And it's active, and people are commenting on the stuff that I'm posting. So it's the activity that's important. It's a conversation. So BitChute is a conversation on my channel that's worth getting involved in. What else have I got to talk about? Let's have a think. What else am I doing? That's more or less it. I think I'm happy with the way things are going. And if I focus on BitChute and on Rumble, I'll see if I can get Rumble going. I'm not sure about how Rumble functions as a system. I was looking at material on there that I wanted to use on the radio show, but they've got a licensing deal on it. I had a look at the license and it was $400 to use it for broadcast. So what I might do is see if I can structure something that's about 10 or 15 minutes long, that's a very specialist show that's designed for a specific kind of target market, and see if I can license my stuff to Rumble, and then I might start being able to make some money from it. But I'm going to have to think about which audience I want to target, which market I want to target for a specific show. It has to be something that I've got some experience or expertise in, really. Otherwise, I'd just be reading articles. And I don't want to necessarily just read articles off the internet, although I might end up doing that as well. So that's a possibility. I did have a light paper floating around somewhere. Let me just go and see if I can find that, because I can read an article out of there for the last 5 minutes. Hang on a sec. Don't know where I put it. Where did I put it? All right, let's just have a look through this, because this is issue number 22, and the light paper comes out monthly. I gave one of these to a guy who was walking past yesterday, and he looked at the picture on the front of it, which is a bit of a psychedelic kind of spirally thing, and he looked at it and he went, it's about LSD. And the headline on the front says, "Are we all being brainwashed?" So he didn't connect the picture to the headline. And then he gave me the paper back because he didn't want to read a paper about LSD. So it failed on that level, but it's a good article, good enough article. I'll read the headlines from here. It says, "How to Create a Pandemic, Medicine in the Matrix." And then I've got The Psychology of Totalitarianism, which is Matthias Desmet's book. So there's a two-page article on that. The Hidden Secret of Electricity, which I'm still getting my head around the possibility that electricity doesn't flow through wires at all, and that it's actually just being pulled out of the air. Not seeing it takes me a while to get my head around these things, but that's one of the things that I'm looking at. So what else have we got? Freedom activist sections. Twitter does not believe in free speech. Stakeholder Capitalism, How Corporations Will Rule the World, and a picture of Klaus Schwab. Try Not to Believe Everything You Think. 7 Questions to Ask About the COVID Vaccine. So some of this is fairly standard stuff. So there's an article about Rudolf Steiner's approach to political structures, which is one page long. And what have you got? A centerpiece about logical fallacies. So that'll be useful to refer to. So it's not a bad little paper all in all. It's free. I mean, it says on the front 50p where sold, but I've never seen it sold anywhere. We just give it away. So it has an effect on some people and not on others. So that's the thing. So people give quite a few away to drivers as they're going past if they wind the window down or whatever. So it does have an impact, but I'm not sure how much of an impact it actually has, because they can just be being polite, really. There's no way to know they're actually reading the material. So that's me for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm gonna drop off now, I think. I've got some organising to do, some cleaning to do, and some laundry to do. So the music will kick in any second. Thanks for listening, and I'll have a good week, and I'll see you next week. I'll be back on Monday with the music show on the Hawk's Nest, and on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, possibly Thursday, possibly Friday, and then back on Saturday with Free Association. So thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.
It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
Are you interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
What the heck is the truth, jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio.